Welcome to A Time for Change. I'm Kristen Myers here with Sabeel Marcellus. Now, with the new school year getting underway in parts of the country, we are devoting today's program to education. First up, how to handle the incredibly high costs of college. Now, get ready for some sticker shock here. If you include room and board, last year, the full price for 1 year at a private four-year college or university was more than $50,000. Now, at a public institution, it was $38,000 for out-of-state students and more than $22,000 for in-state. Now, of course, that's out of reach for so many families.
But our first guest is trying to help by connecting students to those much-needed scholarships. His company is called Scholly. Think of it as Tinder for scholarships. Joining us now is Christopher Gray, founder of Scholly and author of Go Where There Is No Path, Stories of Hustle, Grit, Scholarship, and Faith. Chris, so your app Scholly matches students with those scholarships, but how often are they successful in securing those scholarships?
Well, we've helped students win about $100 million in scholarships so far. So it's been pretty successful. The next 5 years, of the past 6 years, we've been around. And after launching it on Shark Tank, we have so much visibility. We have become the brand leader, the market leader in the space. We have about 4 million users right now. So it's been pretty cool. And we facilitated a lot of money. Now we even have people, wealthy individuals, brands, and things coming to us to facilitate more scholarships through our platform, exclusively through our platform.
All right, Chris, I'm hoping you can do a little bit of context setting for us here and describe, you know, why Scholly is even needed in the first place. How difficult is it right now for students to even get scholarships, and particularly students of color?
Yeah, so I actually started Scholly because I won $1 million in scholarships myself, so that was kind of the origin story around it. And the problem is, the problem that Scholly is solving is that there are hundreds of millions of dollars of scholarships out there, and a lot of students didn't know they exist until we created the product. So there was a lot of money just going unclaimed. So there was a lot of students really who qualified money, especially students of color and people in underserved communities who qualify for all this cash, but they just didn't know it existed. So that was the real problem. So and for the people that did search for it, it took them months to search for all this money, right? So one of the things we always say about Scholly is that we turn the months of looking for scholarships into a few minutes, because suddenly we're constantly giving you these opportunities. We also track you all the way up until you graduate college. Most students think that they think you look for scholarships in high school, then you go into college, then you stop. Actually, the majority of our users are actually current college students who are actually using the app every single year to continue to pay for fall semester, spring semester, et cetera. So that really is the gap that we're building. So we have a lot of users, and we've been able to facilitate a lot of our app. And then actually a good majority of our users are actually African-American. And because of that, we've actually worked with partners to create scholarships specifically for HBCU students, students of color. Especially last year, we had a lot of brands come to us around the Black Lives Matter movement asking how they can facilitate different dollars and capital to the community through scholarships. So we've been able to use our data to scale those efforts and impact the right communities.
Chris, your app helps students find scholarships, but student loan debt continues to be a major issue in the nation. In fact, recently, President Biden, he extended that pause on federal student loan debt repayments to January of next year. Yeah. But it's as high as $1.4 trillion. Should President Biden just cancel that debt?
I think ideally, yes, right? I think that especially we know that in communities of color specifically, student debt, you know, has played a huge role in a lack of mobility, right? A lot of people can't get houses. It affects your credit. And a lot of people default because, if they get laid off or they're just a student loan bill, I mean, their bills just don't match. So Scholly now actually has a product called Scholly Payoff that we're preparing for when student loan forbearance ends, that if a student if college graduates are not enrolled in school, they have they are unemployed, or they have income that does not match what they make, we're able to auto-enroll them in income-based repayment plans very quickly rather than it taking them months to do that. And the reason I bring that up is because a lot of students, a lot of graduates don't actually know these programs exist. So you have someone paying $1,200 a month for student loans who probably should be paying $200 a month based on their income. So that's a really big part of that. You know, I think waiting on the government to forgive student debt is like, you know, I wouldn't hold my breath on that. But I think that what you can control is making sure that you are paying back your student debt as it relates to your income. We also, Scholly also regularly runs student loan payoffs. We actually finished $1 million student loan payoff. We do with Natty Lyle every year. So, and we facilitate a lot more throughout the year. So there are a lot of, you know, if you go to our website, there are a lot of competitions that we run to actually help pay off student debt. We actually partnered with Gronish 2 years ago and paid off a bunch of people's student debt. So we try to do as much as we can, but making sure that your student loan payments are a portion of their income is the immediate thing that I think people can do before student loan forbearance ends to make sure that, you know, they have things under control.
Let's just talk about the system in general, however, because a lot of these scholarships, to an extent, seem a little bit like a Band-Aid on this gaping wound of skyrocketing college costs for degrees that don't necessarily guarantee high-paying salaries for graduates. Do you think that perhaps the whole system, all of higher education, needs a financial overhaul?
Yeah. So I think that, 100%. So I think that COVID, you know, was definitely, being in this pandemic was just hard for everyone. But I think we really started to see an opportunity in this space where, you know, you can do a lot online, and maybe there's this hybrid model or model where there can be a virtual, you can get a degree from a Morehouse, a degree from Harvard, whoever, where their virtual degree, those virtual classes are a lot more significantly less than the being physically on campus. So I think that's one opportunity. And also, I think that there's a big movement towards skills training, right? Where you see a lot of companies, including Google, including my company, Scholly, where people have hired people who've proven they can do the work. They didn't necessarily have a degree. So I think that I think a lot of things around skills training, whether it's web design, app design, sales, et cetera, I think that we're going to get to a movement where people can really focus on their skills. But you're 100% right. Like, I don't remember the last time I ever used a derivative of a calculus, like in any aspect of my real life, right? And not to a lot of people. So I do think that combating college costs is reinventing education. And I think college is starting to reinvent what a degree is, right? Like if I can get a degree that may cost less, but it trained me in sales or trained me how to, you know, code or trained me how to, be an accountant, et cetera. Like how do you make that model work where it's still, where the revenue is still there for the universities, but it's significantly less for the actual students because the amount of resources the university has to deploy is significantly less because of those condensed programs. So that's why I think that's where the industry is going to move. And I think that's where it's getting to.
And Chris, what motivated you to write that book, Go Where There Is No Path?
I think that a lot of people, especially people from underserved communities, people of color, we really navigate the world with a lot of insurmountable odds. And what I really wanted to do was really show people that whether they're trying to pay for college, navigating a college, navigating being in college, getting education, whether they want to start a company or any aspect of their career, build a company, scale it, or, you know, take a new job, et cetera, that, you know, how to navigate those challenges and how to hustle and use grit to overcome those different things in a different way. And I do a lot of speaking engagements. People come to me for advice all the time. So one way is like, hey, let me just put this in a book so I can just help, put it out there as much as possible. It's really been something that I think that's really thing. I think that the world always tells us no. And I think that, you know, and I think that we, and learning how to navigate the world with our own yeses and the book like really talks about not just a pep talk, but it's really actionable things and actual life lessons that, you know, people can learn. That's a playbook on really how to navigate the world and how to create ways when people are telling you no, when society is telling you no, when race is the issue, when poverty is the issue, when, you know, when you have those barriers and when there's no direct path right in front of you.
Absolutely. Everyone wants to navigate the world with more yeses. Christopher Gray, it was great to have you on. Thanks so much.
Thank you. All right.
And coming up next, we hear from a panel of high school students about how they're navigating the pandemic and what's ahead. Welcome back to A Time for Change. As the Delta variant surges, it's unclear what's ahead in this school year. What's on students' minds as they go to school, and how has COVID changed them? To get some insight, Yahoo Finance's Reggie Wade sat down with a diverse group of juniors and seniors from a White Plains high school in New York, where the vast majority of students are students of color. Here's what they had to say about how the pandemic has changed their view of the world.
I just saw a lot of equity issues in the world because, you know, where I'm from Brazil, and we didn't even get the vaccine, like the full, all of the vaccines are just coming out now. And that's not really fair, since, like, why should the U.S. get a lot of vaccines but Brazil shouldn't? Because, you know, Brazil is really suffering from that. And other countries are too. So I see this like more of a, and it's not just like about countries and like nation, global-wide stuff. It's also about, you know, when COVID first came out, a lot of celebrities got the testing first. And that's not fair because, you know, why should they be safer than we should be?
I agree with what Thiago said, and I'm from Colombia, so I also think that, like, the government from my country over there, they didn't really take seriously at first the pandemic and the whole virus. So they didn't react as quick, and, like, I would always be scared of my family over there, since all my family's over there, my grandparents, and being here, I wasn't able to go see them again, and you wouldn't know, like, what could happen to them.
I had somebody in my family, you know, pass away because of COVID, and I'm 100% sure that it would not happen if they had been in the U.S. because the U.S. has so many resources, so many health departments and everything that take care of people, and other countries don't.
What would you guys tell your future children about what it was like living through a pandemic? Carter.
I'll probably tell them, like, it was like being grounded for almost a year, like, right? Yeah, almost a year. Can't really do a lot of things outside of your house. You know, you have to be really safe, really cautious with what you do. And I mean, they probably still wouldn't get it. They probably still wouldn't trust me when I say it, but it really happened. It really affected us in a crazy way.
Evelyn?
I would probably tell them that it was very difficult to learn online. At least for me, having to share, like, my home space, like, my happy place into, like, my school area, or, like, it was really difficult to try to be productive. Because when you're in school, like, in a normal life, it's like you're here for 6-7 hours, and then you go home and you're like, okay, I'm going to spend 2 hours on my homework. That's fine. Like, you can do that. But having to sit there for 7 hours behind a screen or in front of a screen, and then to have you switch it to, like, okay, now I can relax. It was pretty difficult to, like, adjust to that. So I would tell them the struggles of that.
I think that our children would probably be used to having screens in front of them all day. I think that, you know, how education is going, all these freshmen are getting iPads, all these kids are getting iPads, and they're starting at a young age. Like, kids are getting iPads in elementary school, and I don't think that you should be done that way, because you shouldn't stay on a screen all day long. That's not... I don't see how that's good for education. So I don't think they're going to care too much about us being, like, on our Zoom calls all day. But I am going to tell them that, you know, I was in a pandemic and it was getting serious because a lot of people died, and that they should be grateful they don't have to deal with that.
Andres?
I agree with what he said. I also think that, like, kids from such a young age shouldn't be too much into technology. I believe that it's because the way I was raised, but I don't think it's good for their health and all that. And I mean, as like Thiago said, education is going to keep moving forward with technology, so they're just going to keep implementing it and making it better for us to learn.
Yeah. Brian?
I think it was a unique period of time. Especially on the talk of children and technology, this is the only school that some kids have ever known, like kids in kindergarten. This is their first year of school. And it will drastically change as time goes on, but they don't know any different.
Rena?
I think COVID-19 will be a generation divide, much like we would never know how it felt to be alive during 9/11. They will never know how it would feel to be alive during this pandemic. And I think they'll always be, like, in disbelief at what we went through. And I think the only thing we can hope to instill in them is everything we've learned during this pandemic, what we've learned to value, you know, human connection, being in school. Like, hopefully we can instill that in them so that they won't take anything for granted like we did.
So Are you guys hopeful for the future?
Yeah, of course. I mean, everyone should have hope, you know. Right now, we're slowly, like very slowly, inching our way, getting back into stuff. But now with this this new one, I think it's going to be, we're going to have hope just in case if this one does become as big as COVID. But yeah, I think hope is like a really good thing to have all around whenever you need it.
Yeah, Rena?
I think that at least in the U.S., we will definitely be out of COVID. We won't be affected by it. And I think it's important to remember that while we might not still be in the midst of a pandemic, there's other places in the world that might be still affected by it. But I hope, and I think it's so important for everyone to hope and not just like wish, but to also work towards making the world a better place after COVID.
And Reggie is with us to give us some more insight into this important conversation. Reggie, as a former teacher yourself, were you surprised by what these kids said?
I think I'm a bit surprised. I was more impressed. You hear these students talk and care about the world around them, not just what's going on in their bubble. They say kids are egocentric, but you wouldn't know that from speaking to these students. They were extremely thoughtful young men and young women. So I left feeling very impressed and very hopeful for the future after speaking with these kids.
Absolutely. Definitely hopeful for the future. And thanks so much, Reggie. And coming up, a conversation with two of Shaquille O'Neal's kids on playing NCAA ball and building their own brands.
Classes begin next week at Texas Southern University, a historically black university in Houston. Now, among the new students are two basketball recruits named Shakir and Amira, or as she's called, Mimi O'Neal. Their dad is none other than the NBA legend Shaquille O'Neal. Now, Shakir will be a freshman. Mimi, who is transferring her from her dad's alma mater, LSU, will be a sophomore. Alexis Christophorus talked to the two of them about building their own brands and the pressures of following in their dad's size 22 footsteps.
In the beginning, I feel like it was a little bit hard for me to deal with all the pressure and everything that comes with it. But as I got older, I became a little more confident and really like, basically, I live up to my expectations.
Right. To live up to your own expectations.
Yeah.
Shakir, what about you? Same question. How does it feel for you, you know, sort of having your dad's shadow sort of hanging over you, like I say, for better or for worse?
I feel like it's no pressure at all for me. It's pressure makes diamonds, and I just do whatever makes me happy. So I feel like it's no pressure at all. I'm just a regular guy, so I just go out there, do what I love, and play the sport of basketball. I don't really listen to what anybody else say unless it's really important to me, if it's coming from a coach or a family member.
I like that. I like that attitude. That seems pretty healthy. When you chose the offer from Texas Southern, Shakir, you wrote on social media that you, quote, wanted to change the narrative of culture. What did you mean by that?
I just wanted to show athletes that you can go to any school, especially HBCU, and take over and still get to the NBA. And I feel like with me being one of the first like top athletes in my class to go there, I feel like a lot of younger kids are going to start doing it, and it's going to like change the narrative for basketball, college basketball.
I want to ask you both about what the NCAA did recently, which is historic, after years of debate, finally allowing student athletes to monetize their name, image, and likeness while still in school. Just first off, Mimi, what was your reaction when they announced that new policy?
I was actually really excited because I do actually love business. I've always wanted to start my own. So when they made that rule, I was very excited.
I thought it was great because a lot of athletes who can make money off their names, especially in college. And it's a great opportunity for like young athletes in college right now.
And you certainly, both of you have watched your dad monetize his name, image, and likeness, albeit after college, because those rules were not in place when he was in school in the 1990s. Mimi, what have you learned from the way your dad has built his brand over the years?
I've actually learned a lot from him just by watching, you know, what he does, how he acts towards people, how generous he is. I feel like that has a lot to do with how successful he is now.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And Shakir, what have you learned from the way your dad has built his brand?
I learned a lot. He's like a very, very smart man. He's a very smart businessman. He treats everybody the same, no matter who you are. He's like, he's very nice to people. And he told me just, if you're ever going to do business with someone or something, just make sure you believe in it and you do your research about it.
And we wish both Shakir and Mimi the best of luck in their upcoming season. That is all for today's Time for Change. But before we head to break, I did want to share some bittersweet news. Today will be my last day hosting Time for Change. For the last year, it has been not just my pleasure, but honestly also an honor to have conversations about inequities and injustice and solutions as we move forward in education and healthcare and investing and so much more. I have learned so much from working with you, Sabil, from working with Alexis Christophorus, but also, of course, our production staff, which I absolutely have to thank. My many best thanks to Betsy, to Pam, and to Brent. I will miss you all, but again, I am absolutely honored to have been able to have all of these experiences with you.